This is Politics is Local, a special election time program series from KHOI Community Radio. We bring you an exploration of candidates, constituents, and issues of our community. I'm your host for today, Kate Partook. The phrase, all politics is local, is a popular saying, most often associated with the former House Speaker Thomas P. or Tip O'Neill, who used the saying in his first election campaign in 1935. During election time, we ask ourselves what questions are important and what long-term effects our decisions will have. Let's hear a couple of brief clips to give us an idea of some of the issues that are going on today.
Experiencing a whirlwind of emotions right now, confusion, hurt, pain, anger. We know that there was no gun in the car.
Right.
We know he was unarmed.
Yeah.
We know he was moving slow. We knew he didn't commit a crime like the New York bomber did, who's still alive.
Yeah.
We know all of those things, but my brother is dead.
We saw his hands up.
Absolutely.
We didn't see what was in a car, and it has nothing to do with the actions taken because the officers couldn't see what was in a car. We demand immediate justice. There ought to be an immediate trial and an immediate trying of the evidence and stop the judicial stalling, because justice delayed is justice denied.
We're heartbroken.
No one thinks the sentencing bill is perfect, as it represents a compromise among people with strong differences of opinion. But the people of this country want action to address deficiencies in the criminal justice system.
That was, first of all, civil rights activist Al Sharpton speaking with the sister of Terence Crutcher, who was recently killed by police in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And the second clip, Senator Chuck Grassley speaking to the Senate about his sentencing reform and corrections bill. Today we're looking at criminal justice. What issues are currently at stake in this area? KHOI reporter Whitney Wright is here with me. Whitney, to start us out, could you please give us a definition of the parameters of criminal justice?
Hello, it's nice to be here again today. And yes, criminal justice is the system of practices and institutions of governments directed at upholding social control, deterring and mitigating crime, or sanctioning those who violate laws with criminal penalties and rehabilitation efforts. In preparation for this show, we spoke with people in the area who have experience and ideas about criminal justice in their relationship to elections. We also have found some statements made by national candidates running for office in the upcoming elections. Issues raised were interconnected and overlapping, but generally included laws and legislation, law enforcement, the judicial system, and even general societal and cultural habits and state of mind.
Okay, let's start locally. KHOI reporter Greta Anderson spoke with Story County Sheriff Paul Fitzgerald on his experiences and concerns about law enforcement and how they connect with larger issues in the election process. Fitzgerald is running for office currently, although he is unopposed.
This is Greta Anderson. I'm with Sheriff Paul Fitzgerald, who is actually running in this upcoming election, but he is running unopposed. I'm here to talk with him about what the election means for his job. As a law enforcement officer, his job is determined by the laws that our lawmakers make and the policies that executive branch sets out. And so I would think that you have quite a bit to say about what you hope for in this upcoming election.
Well, when I've been out in the campaign trail in the past, I sometimes get asked, why is a sheriff, a law enforcement person, elected? And to me, I think that's a very important part of our government here in America. The sheriff is the only law enforcement person which is elected. At the federal level, the FBI director, DEA director, Secret Service director, all these federal positions are appointed by the president. At the state, the public safety commissioners are appointed by the governors. And in the cities, the police chiefs are all appointed by the mayor or city council. And the sheriff, to this day, remains the only elected law enforcement person who's directly accountable to the public. So if the public is not happy with their sheriff and what the sheriff is doing, then they don't stay in office very long. And I hope that the people in Story County have, over the last 24 years, been watching the services that I've been providing here in Story County, and that they are pleased with what we have done in the Story County Sheriff's Office.
Well, if you did have an opponent, what record would you run on at this time? What would you say you have accomplished here?
I think we've accomplished an awful lot in the sheriff's office. When I first ran for sheriff, I ran on the platform of working with the mentally ill. And we've worked with that all the years that I've been sheriff. And we've worked with it not only here locally, but at the state level and at the national level as well. And as a past president of the National Sheriff's Association, I've been in many sheriff's offices throughout the United States, talked and worked with many sheriff's offices. And it's very easy to see that any county you go to in America here, usually the largest mental health facility in that county is the county jail. And jails are not the appropriate place for people that are nonviolent offenders who are in jail basically because of a mental illness. And when they come to jail, we do our best. We have a mental health provider that works in the jail. We work with our providers to see that we do provide the best care that we can. And we try to work with them to get them out in the community, back outside after they get, of course, back on their medication and stabilized. What we do that's a little bit unique that is not done in other places is that when an individual comes in, and again for a nonviolent offense, what will happen is our mental health professional will begin to evaluate that person. We will then work with the courts, with the county attorney's office, with the public defender's office, and create what's similar to a pretrial release program. And then when the person is released, if they have a mental health provider on the outside, we reestablish them with that provider or their caseworker. But if they do not have a caseworker, then what we do is we have a mental health provider that will work into the community with them for up to 12 to 18 months to make sure they stay on their medication, make sure they're back on their, in some cases, their Social Security disability income, to make sure their medication still comes in, make sure they have housing, that they, if they have a job, that they make their appointments, reestablish with the employer, make sure that they have their court visits, that they don't miss them, and we're trying to reach out and make a difference. I think we're starting to finally get some recognition that people with a mental illness deserve help. They don't deserve jail.
Right. Your role has shifted from law enforcement and protection to a kind of social services. What kind of laws would you like to see the Iowa legislature enact? You go to very extreme efforts, it sounds, because you're filling in a gap that hasn't been filled by existing agencies and laws and funding streams. What would you like to see happen to change that?
Well, one of the things that I think is very important is what you just said, the funding. And there's so many things that we have to do in law enforcement, but we're asked to do more with less. And so that spreads us out thinner. It spreads the resources and what we can provide back to the community. It spreads very thin. And at the national level, I've been at the White House and had meetings and representing the National Sheriff's Association. I've been in Congress talking, and the funding and resources that can come from the federal government and come from the state as well, that's where we need to have the support. So many times we see across the country the recent tragedies that we've had with the active shooter situations, whether it's schools, churches, businesses, wherever, they're just happening at an alarming rate. And what they'll say is, well, the person obviously had a mental illness. to me, it seems they know what some of the problems are here, but there's no real funding for mental health. I think if we're going to have a real effective action taken, that more funding needs to be put into the mental health system.
If the funding were there, how would it best be directed in your experience?
Well, we're working also in trying to figure out a way to create a placement where an individual that's on the street, that again, that's nonviolent, that is going into a mental health crisis, that they could be taken to, like, where the community life program was, to one of the cottages they have there that we'd have staff with a mental health provider, and they could be dropped off there instead of being brought to jail, to get them reconnected back with their mental health providers out in the community. But the task force, again, we're working to see if we can establish this safe zone, and we're just working with the Board of Supervisors, city government, and seeing wherever other funding possibilities and funding streams can come from to see if we can put this in play.
Criminal justice has been in the news a lot for the last couple years. Just this week we had an incident in Tulsa where an unarmed black man was shot who did not appear to be threatening in any way by law enforcement. In Iowa, we do have a crisis of disproportionate representation of African Americans in our jails and prisons. So I guess my question to you is, have we done enough in Iowa to improve the situation?
Primary thing for law enforcement continues, I believe, to be education and training. And most of my people, especially that are on specialty teams and units, they'll receive well over 100 hours of training a year.
And does any of that training that your officers received, does any of that specifically address issues of bias, racial bias, and perceptions of threat to the officer because a person is of color?
Yes, we have had training similar to that. We are reviewing now and looking at the 21st century policing model that has just recently come out of the White House, and that will be one of the things we'll be discussing in our upcoming retreat, and what type of training we will be looking at to bring in a bias-based training to show how everyone has biases, how biases are interpreted, and how biases one person might use towards another, even though unsuspectingly you don't believe they're doing it. But when you're trained and you can see what that is, it sheds a whole new light on it and a whole new perception by the officer. One of the things that's come out of Ferguson is body cameras that officers wear. The sheriff's office, we began using body cameras 2 years before Ferguson occurred. And we're in our third version of, actually our fourth version of body cameras as we continue to improve on the style of camera that our employees wear here at the sheriff's office.
Have you gotten any feedback from your officers about what that's like to wear a body camera?
Well, this day and age with iPhones, you're always going to be on camera. So this is an opportunity for law enforcement to show what the officer was seeing, and more often than not, it justifies the officer's actions than condemns the officer's actions. And this year, we are on the rate to having the most police officers shot and killed in the line of duty. We've had officers that were ambushed in Texas and Louisiana. The officer, deputy that was ambushed while eating lunch within 20 miles from the White House in Maryland, and then when he came out, was engaged with another deputy and killed another deputy, and then before they finally found that individual. All lives do matter. Police officers' lives, black lives matter, all lives matter. But don't lose track that police officers are out here, and the vast majority of law enforcement officers, that makes thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of contacts every day throughout this country, that look at how very few come back with a bad situation.
What do you make of the disparity of African Americans in Iowa's jails and prisons?
Laws are created by the legislature, and the courts, the Supreme Court and the lower courts, interpret those laws, and it's law enforcement that carries out those laws. For the disparity of why there are so many black individuals incarcerated as opposed to others. That's something that is being studied at the state and at the national level. I know because I'm on the Brennan Center study group at the White House entitled Law Enforcement Leaders to Reduce Crime and Incarceration. And we have sheriffs and chiefs and prosecuting attorneys and defense attorneys and judges that sit on this committee. And we meet, last time we met was 2 days in Washington, and then the second day we're in the White House and having the meeting. So it's being looked at. Nothing changes 90 degrees. It takes a gradual curve, but it's at the forefront. The White House is talking about it. Congress is talking about it. So it is being looked at, and it is being studied.
Sheriff Paul Fitzgerald, thank you very much.
You're listening to Politics is Local on KHOI Community Radio, a special program series in anticipation of the November elections, exploring some of the issues at stake with voices of candidates and constituents. I'm your host for this hour, Kay Puttock, here with KHOI reporter and researcher Whitney Wright. During this hour, we're looking at issues of criminal justice. We just heard from Storey County Sheriff Paul Fitzgerald, who was sharing his thoughts on connections between elements and agency of criminal justice from the perspective of his law enforcement position. Sheriff Fitzgerald spoke about training for officers for the 21st century, a policing model coming from the White House in order to address racial bias that's being considered for use in Iowa. The recent police shootings of black men in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and Charlotte, North Carolina, have once again raised the question about racial bias in enforcement. And this morning, I just heard a snippet of the news this morning as I was coming here, and I think there was another person just shot again today by the police, apparently. I'm not sure if I got it right. It was just a snip of I heard on the radio. And it's well known that the percentage of people of color incarcerated in Iowa exceeds their representation in American society as a whole. 56% of the U.S. prison population is black or Latino, yet those groups of people represent only 30% of the United States population as a whole. Whitney, you've been researching race and criminal justice in Iowa. What have you found?
Yes, I have been researching. And as of 2013, the African-American population in Iowa is just a mere 3.4% of the total population, yet 25% of the Iowa prison system, according to the Iowa Data Center. The U.S. Bureau of Justice and FBI found that black people were arrested more than other races in Iowa, with Bettendorf and Cedar Falls having some of the highest disparities. The ACLU found that 8 times out of 10, black people are more likely to be arrested for a small amount of marijuana than white people, even though it was used at the same rate. And January this year, Governor Branstad, during his condition of the state speech, used the word significant racial disparity to describe conditions in Iowa, both praising the Iowa Supreme Court and President Betty Andrews of the Iowa-Nebraska NAACP chapter.
What are the reasons for this discrepancy in the kinds of people who end up in prison?
Well, looking into specifics, we found causes affecting Iowans and the nation. A press conference was called in Washington, D.C. civil rights activists and lawmakers that called attention to the problem of racial profiling. Activist Lakshmi Sridhan articulated how this problem is embedded in society today.
The implicit bias that we internalize as a result of our culture and what we hear from our leaders and so many of the racist policies in this country, that's, you know, what usually initiates law enforcement to profile someone. And then you have the issue of the excessive use of force that is often accompanied by these interactions with law enforcement. And as we've seen in so many cases, that use of force is then justified because that racial profiling is seen as okay and acceptable.
One of the things that people talk about particularly is cocaine, and you can find all kinds of articles about this. The laws that were passed more stringently regulated and enforced the restrictions on crack cocaine than on powder cocaine. And that ended up to be associated with the level of income and therefore the level of poverty and therefore race, because there are proportionately more people of minorities who fell into that group than of the people who use powder cocaine, you know, who tended to be, you know, like white college student types, that kind of thing.
Did people perceive crack cocaine as more dangerous, or was there inherent racism in the making of this law?
Do you know, I have never done any research on that, so I cannot tell you that. It might be very interesting for you to delve further into that, but I don't remember what the rationale was for the difference.
I think I remember. There were pretty sensational articles about how dangerous crack was, but it might be this unconscious racism that was fueling that.
There is endemic racism in our society, and so it's hard to say where its effects begin and end. Mm-hmm. I think that's an important thing for people to keep in mind.
What do you mean by endemic racism?
Well, what I'm talking about there is racial prejudices. Everybody has prejudices. Everyone does, no matter what their background, their race, their education. Everyone has prejudices. And often we are not able to identify these in ourselves. We think, no, I'm not prejudiced. But we are unable to actually analyze our own behavior, our own unconscious behavior.
Right. If we use the word maybe biases, people can maybe understand better. Because if you hear the word prejudice, you tend to think of hateful behavior and so on. But biases can be things that you're completely unaware of.
Right. Well, prejudice are things you can be completely unaware of,
they
too.
They can, of course.
But you're right. Biases probably has a much less... it's a much more neutral term,
mm-hmm.
And I think you're right. Probably bias is the best word to use there. What are legislative approaches that could reduce the bias or the effects of the bias?
Yes.
And one thing that I think we are seeing now in black, white, and color is the fact that as we have more and more laws requiring body cams to be carried and used by police officers on themselves and in police cars, we are seeing more and more of the effects of unconscious bias. And it's becoming more apparent to people. People are becoming more aware of it. And as they become more aware of it, they will be able to better deal with it and say, oh, yeah, there's not a rational reason for my reacting this way, you know.
That was Mary Richards, former Story County attorney, speaking about another reason why racial disparities exist in Iowa's incarceration ratios. She explains prejudice in drug laws, but with also pointing out what she calls basic and endemic racism.
Right, and that was interesting because Sheriff Fitzgerald was saying, you know, the laws are completely unbiased, we just enforce the laws, but the laws about crack cocaine, treating crack cocaine more severely than powder cocaine, that does seem to be, as far as we can tell, a prejudicial law. So now Mary did say we need more research, we can't really tell, but that certainly seems to be the case. Why should crack cocaine be treated as a greater crime than powder cocaine if it's not something to do with race? Now let's hear Senator Chuck Grassley speaking to the Senate about his sentencing reform and corrections bill. Let's hear the whole speech. We heard a snip of it at the beginning, but let's hear a bigger piece of that speech.
I come here to continue to believe that the Senate should take up the Sentencing Reform and Corrections Act. There's still time this year for both the Senate and the other body to pass legislation reforming sentencing. In light of recent and justified public concerns over treatment of suspects by some police and treatment of police by people who would do them harm, the need for the bill is even greater today. The Sentencing Reform and Corrections Act contains three parts, each of which was formed as the basis of a bipartisan compromise among Judiciary Committee members as well as members not on the Judiciary Committee. The first is a reduction in the mandatory minimum sentences for nonviolent drug offenders. The bill takes great pains to limit sentencing reductions to people with minimal criminal histories and no history of serious violence. Second, the bill enhances prison programming that has been proven to reduce the likelihood of reoffending and reduces the sentences of inmates who successfully completed these programs. Reducing the likelihood of future crimes reduces the crime rate. And third, the bill makes various reforms to the federal criminal justice system. For instance, it allows people convicted of certain crimes as juveniles to expunge their criminal record if they turn their lives around. And it remedies a constitutional defect in federal criminal law by permitting individuals sentenced to life sentences as juveniles to seek parole after many years, but doesn't guarantee that parole will be granted. It even adds two new mandatory minimum sentences to the federal criminal code for serious crimes, and I emphasize that just because everybody thinks that this is just weakening every criminal law you could ever think of. The confidence of people in the criminal justice system is not as strong as we would like. There are various reasons for this lack of trust, and some of them are valid. The Judiciary Committee reported a compromise bill that is designed to address some of these concerns. The sponsor's willingness to compromise was further demonstrated by a manager's amendment that narrowed the bill's sentencing reductions. Those changes responded to concerns of some of my Republican colleagues and brought on board a number of new Republican co-sponsors. I have been willing for a long time to enter into an agreement where members can offer amendments of various kinds and we can vote. For instance, the House has determined that a provision of substantive criminal law addressing intent should be a part of any bill. I've been open to any compromise on that issue that could gain 60 votes, and I would agree to have a vote on the subject if a compromise cannot be reached. The differences can be aired, and differences that are usually aired are usually resolved. I am certain that this bill would receive many more than the 60 votes, and that most of the Republican conference would vote for it if given a chance. No one thinks the sentencing bill is perfect, as it represents a compromise among people with strong differences of opinion. But the people of this country want action to address deficiencies in the criminal justice system. This bill would make important but limited changes in the way that the federal government sentences those who commit crimes. We should take the bill up, we should debate the bill, and we should show the American people that are we willing to take on one of the most important domestic challenges facing the country, and most importantly, because it's bipartisan, which a lot of people don't see this Congress do very often, and because it's bicameral. There's great move within the House of Representatives that this type of legislation should pass. I yield the floor.
That was Senator Chuck Grassley speaking in the Senate about his Sentencing Reform and Corrections Act. This is Politics is Local on KHOI, a special election time series. At this time, when our voting can and will affect our lives and those around us, we're exploring some of the issues current in our time. I'm Kay Patrick, and Whitney Wright is here with me to help break things down. Whitney, what have candidates said about criminal justice?
Well, when looking at local candidates in Iowa, issues of criminal justice are not strongly expressed as having a significant role in the platforms that they are running on. The noticeable issue being mentioned is funding for mental health, as said by the sheriff. For example, Patty Judge, the Democratic Senate candidate, recently visited several medical centers in Iowa and noticed the lack of beds and facilities as well as mental health professionals. She's hoping to tackle this issue if elected, and Lisa Hedens, our incumbent for the House of Reps, has aided in securing funding for mental health in the past and recently became a co-sponsor for a bill related to children's health and well-being. Now, as far as presidential candidates go, Hillary Clinton has said she looks to strengthen bonds of trust between the community and police through training programs and research, support legislation to end profiling, strengthen the Department of Justice pattern practice use, like monitoring violations, reform mandatory minimum sentencing, which was also like a part of the sentencing reform bill, focus on violent crime and not things like marijuana possession, and prioritize treatment and rehab, and dismantle the school to prison pipeline, like reforming the disciplinary policies. And also, she would like to end private prisons and promote reentry by former incarcerated individuals. Democratic presidential nominee Hillary Clinton.
Live with, you know, fear and anxiety to be profiled, to worry about what will happen to their children when they go out to play or out on a date or go for a drive. We have to listen to the fears of our police officers who get up every day and do a dangerous job, like the police in Dallas who ran toward the shooting when it broke out after a peaceful protest. I'm going to do everything I can in this campaign to try to find common ground, bring people together. And I've got some specific ideas about what we can do for criminal justice reform. We need national guidelines about the use of force, particularly lethal force. We need to work with the 18,000 police departments in our country, some of whom are real models and others should be learning from, about how they de-escalate tension rather than turning a routine traffic stop into a killing. And, of course, we need to investigate the implicit bias that, unfortunately, too many of us still have. And when it's an implicit bias in a police officer, it can lead to an escalating situation. So we've got work to do, certainly our elected officials, our leaders in our communities, but really all of us as Americans have a stake.
Again, that was Democratic presidential nominee Hillary Clinton. Now, Republican candidate Donald Trump is on a different spectrum. He's a believer in swift law and order. He favors tough on crime, but he expresses that we should work with police enforcement to build stronger communities.
Our local police, they know who a lot of these people are. They're afraid to do anything about it because they don't want to be accused of profiling, and they don't want to be accused of all sorts of things. You know, in Israel, they profile. They've done an unbelievable job, as good as you can do, but Israel has done an unbelievable job, and they'll profile. They profile. They see somebody that's suspicious, they will profile. They will take that person in. They'll check out, do we have a choice? Look what's going on. Do we really have a choice? We're trying to be so politically correct in our country, and this is only going to get worse.
If they were given the authority to do it, they would get it done.
How?
You have unbelievable. How? By being very much tougher than they are right now. They're right now not tough.
That was Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump.
Suggesting we be tough, that we profile, or the police should be tough and profile. That seems to be his basic recommendation in that clip.
Which has been the practice since the last criminal justice reform. So I'm not too sure how that would work out. But, well, we have a Libertarian presidential candidate, Gary Johnson, who wants to utilize what he calls a common sense criminal justice reform, which he hopes to reduce recidivism, which is, you know, relapsing and returning into prison. And in the war on drugs, which has devastated so many communities, that he is a strong supporter of our law enforcement as well. So he would also wish to strengthen those communities.
Personally, I really do want to thank law enforcement. I mean, I'm thanking law enforcement out on the streets for putting their lives on the line. That said, I think we've had our heads in the sand regarding racial relations and what is happening.
And for our Green Party presidential candidate, Jill Stein, she's looking to end police brutality and mass incarceration by creating what she calls a Truth and Reconciliation Commission to understand and eliminate injustice in the prison economy, education, housing, and health systems. End funding that militarizes the police force, establish review boards, and investigate extrajudicial killings, like, by the people, like...
Well, without, yeah, killings without a trial, in other words, police shootings.
She wants the review boards to be consisted of the community, rather, you know, someone appointed to that. Also, treat drug use as a health issue and end mandatory minimum sentencing and the death penalty.
Put an end to police violence. We put communities in charge of our police instead of having police in charge of our communities. And that's not rocket science. We do that by creating citizen-controlled police review boards. So the citizens decide who's the commissioner and whether he stays hired or whether he gets fired. It's the people who are going to decide on this commission. We also call for investigators full-time, so every death at the hands of police is investigated.
That was Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein, as I've said. And I would also note that U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch made a statement yesterday saying, "These tragic incidents have once again left Americans feeling full of sorrow, anger, and uncertainty. They have once again highlighted, in the most vivid and painful terms, the real divisions that still persist in this nation between law enforcement and communities of color." And that was her statement at the International Bar Association's annual conference. And that was just yesterday.
Well, thank you for that research and finding those quotes, Whitney. It should also be remembered that presidential elections this year will have a significant effect on criminal justice in the area of the whole judicial system, since the next president will be selecting at least one Supreme Court justice. We'll hear again in this next clip from our former Story County attorney, chief attorney for the Story County, formerly, Mary Richards. She elaborates on the importance of this election in that respect.
One of the things that we're always concerned about is protecting civil rights, protecting the Bill of Rights, protecting the Constitution. And that's something that the justice system is set up. You know, that the justice system is supposed to be based on that. And one of the things I think we need to think about when we're making political decisions right now, when we're getting ready to vote in this election, is which people will represent best what we think is an unbiased and straightforward and inclusive interpretation of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights as it affects everyone. You know, all races, all classes, all kinds of income. And as an example, how important it's going to be to have the president in place in the next election, who will nominate certainly the next Supreme Court justice and possibly, you know, several or at least a few Supreme Court justices during the next 4 years. But also, I saw an article just recently that talked about how important that federal judicial appointment power is with regard to the federal benches in the states and in the judicial districts of the United States, because that has had a big effect on whether laws that were passed that would restrict voter access to the polls are going to be in place in this election. That's an indication, I think, of how important the presidential election is this year.
And now, today, we have Betty C. Andrews, who's president of the Iowa-Nebraska NAACP. In that role, she has led lobbying for legislation on racial profiling and other issues to benefit people of color in Iowa. She has been praised by our very own Governor Terry Branstad for her work. She has joined us by phone. Thank you for joining us this morning.
I am so glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yes.
Yes, welcome, Betty. Thank you very much.
Well, as you know, we've been talking about criminal justice and criminal justice reform. And at this time, how much priority is criminal justice as an issue for the NAACP?
Well, the NAACP has the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. We have prioritized 5 game changers, and these are items that or areas of people's lives that really affect their well-being. And those 5 game changers include economic sustainability, health, they include political action, they include education, and they also include criminal justice. And so I would say that it is definitely at the highest priority of the NAACP. It's important to us because when we look at what is going on in America, and in particular Black America, we see huge disparities between the involvement of African Americans in the criminal justice system versus the involvement of other Americans in the criminal justice system. And in particular, in Iowa, we see that rate as us being, at one point, we were at number one in the nation for incarcerating African Americans. And just recently, the numbers dropped to number 3, which is a step in the right direction, but we've got a long way to go.
Most definitely. And what would you say creates and contributes to the high racial disparity in the prison population?
Well, there are a number of factors. And as I mentioned, those game changers earlier, there's kind of a vicious cycle when you affect those pieces. Some of the we see that in the criminal justice system, but also and quite strongly, there are issues of bias within the system. There are systemic things that are in place that adversely affect African Americans. When you look at every area of discretion, when it comes to arresting, the trial, the actual incarceration, and so on and so forth, the points where there are areas of discretion, usually the choices are made and they're not in favor of African Americans. So an African American is more likely to be arrested or even pulled over for a traffic stop, and then more likely to be arrested, then more likely to go to court and have a verdict against them, and then more likely to serve more time, less likely to get off on probation or parole, and it goes on and on. And so all of those things affect the issue, which is why the NAACP here in Iowa and around the country is working to change laws, to work with policymakers around these issues.
Could you give us like some examples that the Iowa-Nebraska NAACP help to address these disparities?
Well, we do a number of things. I heard you mention Governor Branstad. We meet with him quarterly. We meet with our Chief Justice quarterly, and we talk about these issues and how we can move forward in reducing the incarceration rate. We also have a legislative strategy, and in that strategy, we lobby legislators to help to help them understand the challenges in the criminal justice system, and this past year, one of the things that we did was work with the governor to appoint a criminal justice reform working group, and then the NAACP served on that committee, and that committee made recommendations to the legislature, and a couple of those recommendations are now enacted as laws, and one of those would be that we were able to get it so that juvenile records are kept confidential after a child reaches 18, so they don't have to worry about carrying those burdens on into adulthood, which would affect their livelihood. We also supported legislation around giving low-risk drug offenders another chance after they serve 50% of their mandatory prison system, and that affects about 1,000 Iowans, and then other Iowans going on into the future. So some huge progress, but certainly a lot more to go.
I agree. We definitely have a long ways to go. And as we were talking about earlier, you mentioned a justice summit. Does that have anything to do with how you carry out legislative action?
So we have our fourth annual Iowa Summit on Justice and Disparities coming up on November 4th. And that summit has been a catalyst for making change within Iowa. It is something where we bring together people from all areas of the criminal justice system, along with people who have been involved in the criminal justice system, and we talk about ways to make change. And that summit has been very successful. As a matter of fact, that is where last year the governor appointed the criminal justice working group. And from that, and having those conversations and having those presentations, and we bring in experts for that. From that, we have seen a strong kind of it's been coalition building. It's been eye-opening for people who are working within the system, and it's an opportunity for all of us to work together, because nobody wants to see Iowa at the top of this disparity list. It's embarrassing. And so we all have worked together to make changes. And so it has definitely been a powerful part of this journey.
Well, your efforts are definitely appreciated at this time, and close to the election, they'll have this summit. So with saying that, since we're a little short on time during this election, what are some key issues that you think are at stake? What do you think voters who care about racial disparities should be looking for in a candidate?
Sure. One of the things that we always tell people is definitely, vote your issues. Don't look at the candidate just as the person. Look at what exactly their support. So get your checklist. What are the things? I mentioned the five game changers. How is each candidate affecting you in the area of economic sustainability, in the area of criminal justice? What are their views on those issues? And from there, make your own judgment. But we do encourage, we have a certain number of issues, and we just encourage people to compare what the candidate's saying to what those issues are. And then also take a look at, we're in Iowa, candidates reach out to us all the time. Look at who is reaching out to you and who is willing to have that conversation. And that is both at the local level and at the national level.
I definitely agree with you. Thank you for leaving us on that note. Again, this was Betty C. Andrews, president of the Iowa-Nebraska NAACP. Thank you for sharing your thoughts today with us, Betty.
Yes, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am. You have a good day.
You've been listening to Politics is Local on KHOI Radio. We've been focusing on criminal justice and the possible impact of criminal justice on the upcoming elections. We've just been speaking with Betty Andrews, president of the Iowa and Nebraska NAACP. Thank you for listening. As we close out, let's end with a few more pertinent observations from Mary Richards, former Story County attorney. So, just to summarize, what are the things regarding justice, what are the things you think voters should bear in mind as we're approaching the elections?
Whether the persons that you are planning to vote for hold a view toward criminal justice that is not tough on crime, but that is correct on crime, that is smart on crime. Because too often people tend to think tough on crime means to charge somebody, convict them, throw them in prison, throw away the key. Being smart on crime, in fact, may mean funding prevention programs so that you don't have so many people committing offenses in the first place. And that's very hard for people to have a long view. That's why it's so problematic when legislatures present legislation in response to a particular heinous crime, because they will tailor it to that particular heinous crime. You know, this kind of murder was so terrible that it requires a capital murder offense. And it's a knee-jerk reaction when you may only have one of those cases in 10 years, and you're going to adjust the criminal system for that one case when it doesn't make sense to spend all those resources in that way.
Do you think the tough on crime stance in the past is one of the leading reasons to mass incarceration?
Oh, yes. In fact, there are still legislators or candidates who tout that. Not nearly so much now as there were necessarily when I was county attorney, I think. But anybody who is running in a district that they view as a conservative district is likely to use that as a password or passphrase, tough on crime. And I much prefer smart on crime because it allows a lot more creative ways to address the problem. Well, money-saving ways to address the problem.
Exactly.
There is nothing that is more resource-intensive than prisons.
Yes, I've read somewhere it costs as much to keep someone in a maximum security prison as to send them to Harvard.
Probably more, I think. I don't know. Because of all the scholarships that are available to Harvard. You don't have any scholarships available to maximum security prisons.
Thing, actually, the recidivism and preparing people to for what they're going to do when they come out of prison. In
it
some countries, they release them, they've got a job lined up, they've got somewhere to live lined up, and all those things taken care of.
We do a very poor job of that here in general.
Currently, there's a prison strike going on in several states over, like, work labors and workers.
Right, as forced labor, basically.
Yeah.
You're working for 20 cents an hour or something like
yeah.
that. Yes.
Thank you for speaking with us, Mary.
Okay, well, thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, you have a good
one. And I hope everybody informs themselves on the issues and goes and votes.
Thank you. I hope they do too.
The cracks in the pavement and tarting my heel and strutting my feet. Is there anything I can do for you, dear? Is there anyone I could call? No and thank you, please, madame. I ain't lost, just wondering. From my hometown, Mayemory's a fridge. From my hometown, ooh, the people I've made are the wonders of my world. Are the wonders of my world. Are the wonders of this world. Are the wonders. I like it in the city when the air is so...